Welcome to Hot D, the officially unofficial podcast for House of the Dragon on HBO. I'm Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking Season 1, Episode 7, titled Driftmark. Aaron, another watch or two, what'd you think about it?
I still think this is an excellent episode. Everything I thought about the other night, I was really pleased. I really even enjoyed... they honestly threw me there at the end with, Laenor surviving and still being out in the world, because again in the book there is he's murdered, everyone agrees it's the Carl, and there is the customary, well, Septon Eustace says this and blah 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 says that, and old Mushroom, he thinks that Daemon had him murdered to clear the path to blah blah blah. Mushroom seems like he's right a hell of a lot more than I thought he would have been when I started reading this book like 3 years ago. But what everyone got wrong, apparently, is that Rhaenyra and Daemon were a little bit more, I guess, merciful towards Laenor than it seems like from the book. And I don't know. I said I don't know where they're going to go with that. It's really exciting, as a book reader, when they kind of throw you a curveball like that. I love the Vhagar stuff. I thought that was just truly epic and really, again, keeps whetting my appetite for when the dragons start fighting each other. They're getting better at it. I thought the actual dragon flying was really great. I really appreciated all the character building, the conversations, the dramatic work.
So everything that they've been doing so well so far. Yeah.
Yeah. The one thing I will say is that, I went and looked at other people's experiences watching this show. And then I also looked into, the behind the scenes and making of this. Again, my television's tuned such that, and I watched this both times in a very dark room, I didn't have any trouble making out what was happening on the screen. But I will say it is pretty ugly and it's pretty washed out and it doesn't look as good. And it seems like it's all... just the most egregious day for night shooting.
You can tell.
You definitely
did say that in the behind the scenes stuff. Because I'm looking at it and I'm going, this is day for night.
I mean, you can see people squinting because it's like high noon out, especially like the kids during those pitch black scenes. It's really obvious when you start looking for it. Like they'll have a torch that is casting no light onto the walls or surrounding people's faces. It's just very uncanny and kind of ugly. And you can shoot day for night. It's not impossible to do it well, but like they just did it in the worst way possible. And I saw a couple theories about why that might be. Maybe before we get into that, I should ask you what you thought of the episode, because this would be a whole other digression. What did you think of the episode,
Jim? I largely agree. I think I thought it was a great episode. I really like, as per usual, some of these just more isolated conversations with people. And of course, the crazy developments at the end. Mm-hmm. And the Vhagar stuff is fun and sort of exciting, but that's honestly not the thing that gets me going here. It's more like Otto congratulating his daughter for trying to assassinate the heir to be, like that kind of insane stuff. That is not as in your face. I really love that stuff. So yeah, this brought a lot of that.
I guess going back to the day for night stuff, I saw some theories about why, because, people, some of the pre-production stuff, because this was among, I guess, the first scenes that they shot on this production, which kind of gave an awkward quality to it that I think worked really well for a funeral. But you'll remember one of the very first pre-production shots we saw, or I guess production shots we saw, was Rhaenyra and Daemon standing on a beach at high noon. And that exact same scene was then color shifted to like make it look like it's midnight on a moonless night. And a lot of people were looking at other production stills from that. And I guess in the background of some of these shots, you can see like power lines and like security fencing and stuff like that. And it's like, well, maybe they made it so dark to kind of hide that. I don't buy that. I don't know what the hell's going on. This is the second high profile Game of Thrones Miguel Sapochnik episode that's been widely seen as too fucking dark. It's not hard to paint out power lines. It's not hard to paint out background fencing digitally. Yeah, I had the television and the viewing conditions to where it made it to where it wasn't unwatchable. Mm-hmm. But I was looking at some people taking shots at their picture, and it is almost literally like a black screen for like minutes of this episode. So like if you've got an older LCD that doesn't have very good, black fidelity. Right. Or you don't have your stuff adjusted correctly, or you're trying to compensate by amping up the brightness, it's going to look washed out and muddy. If you're dealing with like some compression artifacts from you watching it on an app or watching it through a cable box, where a lot of times it kind of fucks up it just compresses shit. It's going to look bad and ugly. And I don't know. I don't think there's any excuse. I don't think there's any excuse for it. Like, again, it's not unwatchable for me because of my TV and my conditions, but like it should look a hell of a lot better. And it's unfortunate.
It's interesting. I don't know why the scene needs to be in twilight here or in what's supposed to be night. I know they send everybody to bed, but why do they have to send everybody to bed in this scene? Couldn't they just kind of jump forward and say, well, we assume everybody went to bed?
Well, I mean, it's like, a dragon heist taking place at night is not the problem. It's just that they just decided not to shoot at night.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and then that's fine too. You can definitely, but like, you know, Nope came out this summer and it has a bunch of night scenes and you can see everything perfectly.
Sure.
And even has some day. It even has a lot of day for night, honestly, on Nope. I remember some people saying that like, oh, Jordan Peele, that wasn't the best day for night, but it was light years better than this stuff. So like, again, I'm not going to harp on this too much, but holy cow, as much as I love Miguel Sapochnik's work and as much as he is just really gifted at shooting action, whew, night episodes, maybe not his forte.
Yeah. Director or the cinematographer can only do so much when the director wants to shoot night scenes in the day.
But, so it's like they shot this at high noon. Everything was beautifully lit. Like if you look at the pre-post-production stills, I don't know why they decided to do this to the fight. Like they had to make the film look this bad. It's not like they just slapped a blue filter over. They did a lot more than that. It's like I said, it's unfortunate because it was a huge barrier for a lot of people. And I wanted to talk about that at length so that we don't have to talk about it for the rest of the episode up front.
Yeah, luckily it was not a huge barrier for me. My TV handled it fine. I guess my settings are fine. Also, crucially, I had all of my lights off. I was down in the basement. There were no light sources distracting from the picture. So I got by. I made do with it. But yeah, it wasn't the best looking thing I've ever seen.
Yeah. And you know, you get the one, the OLEDs, which has the superior kind of black levels and light and dark pixel discrimination. So like you're set up to succeed. So but if you're watching on a laptop or an older LED or LCD panel, woof, it could probably look pretty brutal at lower resolutions and at higher compression rates.
Oh yeah. I remember what his Game of Thrones episode looked like and it was bad. Very bad, because I didn't have this TV.
The long night. The long night. The darkest night.
The muddiest night.
Yeah.
All right. Well, maybe we should get into the recap now. What do you say?
Let's do it.
All right. I'm going to split this first scene kind of into two parts. The ceremony and then the post-ceremony for Lena's funeral. During the ceremony, we see that Otto is back as Hand of the King. He looks down at his pin lovingly. Daemon is giggling about pure bloodlines, and Lena's body is then dumped into the sea, which I like this whole ceremony here. I mean, ignoring, you know, all the shots being taken at Rhaenyra and her children, the ceremony was kind of neat. You know, they say some words out here on this cliffside and then dump the body into the water. As I don't know, I assume like go swim with King Merlin or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, talking about committing the body to the sea and the her progeny, or she's leaving on shore, essentially the way you'd say in a funeral that you are survived by blah blah blah. When you see the funeral, the coffin go to the bottom, you know, there's dozens of others there, so you get the idea that this is a family practice that's gone back a while. Several generations.
Is this a Driftmark or High Tide? I couldn't really tell.
Dude, I think it's supposed to... I think it's supposed to be at high tide because that's where everything else takes place. But like that didn't make sense to me because high tide is very new. And there was like again, dozens bodies. Of caskets. So like maybe high tide was at the place where they just happened to do the funeral custom before. Or maybe you're supposed to understand that they did go back to Driftmark proper, Driftmark actual for this ceremony. And then they transferred everybody. Guess. Yeah.
So I don't know. But yeah, there were a lot of bodies down there. I feel like you need to be a little forward thinking with your funeral customs because there could be a lot of bodies down there. So many bodies, in fact, that maybe they start to pile up out of the water. And that would be very bad. You know, you get another a few dozen generations out. And now we're talking about,
man, how many? I would like to see the calculations on that because it looked like it's 50, 60 feet deep of water. And,
oh, really?
I thought it was
like maybe 15 where they were dumping, but I could be wrong. And you know, when people are pumping out 13 kids.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of 13 coffins. Kids a generation, that water fills up quick.
And I wonder, like, who gets to stay down there? Is it like the Crypts of Winterfell where essentially just the Lord? And, you know, like the royal family, or do you have trusted advisors and second sons and first cousins and third uncles? Like, what is the cutoff for Valyrians getting committed to the deep right here on Driftmark?
Probably just the lords and ladies.
But like I said, I always on the instant cast, I got a kick out of the Merlin King getting name checked. Mm-hmm. That tie to the Valyrians, because just if you skip the instant take, you know, legend has it that the Merlin King gave the Valyrians their Driftwood throne that you'll see later in this episode. And there's you know, there's a lot of interesting lore behind the Merlin King. There's one of my favorite theories of all time is Varys a Merlin, a mermaid or merman? Uh-huh. So yeah, I really like that. I love the priest just staring daggers at Rhaenyra as he's talking about their blood being pure and never being able to thin and Daemon giggling. The children, like, you know, these young children at a funeral, like what the fuck is all, you know, like it's felt very, very true to form, all of it.
I feel like I know who Corlys' brother is going to side with when it comes down to it. Given the looks he's giving Rhaenyra here,
mm-hmm.
as he's speaking, mm-hmm. yeah. Also, I have a question about why Daemon laughs at the blood never thinning. Is it just an awkward laugh because of like how hard people are going at Rhaenyra's kids here?
Yeah, I think it's more of like... It's poor form to do anything, but like him laughing at this guy is kind of like, get the fuck out of here. You know, you're being a little bit too precious with all this. And I know you're talking shit about my niece. I don't like it, but I'm not going to take it super seriously. So that's how I interpret it. I'm kind of like,
those aren't Daemon's kids.
Those aren't Daemon's kids.
Yeah. What Bela and whoever. Aren't actually Daemon's kids, so the bloodline has already been sullied.
You think that's a mildly interesting theory, Jim. You think we just got bastards all around?
Maybe. It's possible. I think Aemond and Aegon are maybe the only true-born children in the whole Targaryen-Valyrian dynasty.
Could be.
We'll see. All right, after the ceremony... Aegon is set to marry his sister, I think, which is pretty weird, but not out of line with the Targaryen customs.
Targaryen as fuck is what it is.
Yeah. Sure. Stop me when you want to talk about this, because I'm just going to kind of bullet point each of these beats in this scene. Larys stares at Allison a lot, and Kristen Cole takes note. Jace and Lena's daughters feel sympathy for each other. One of them is Bela. I don't know the other's name. Do you?
Rhaena.
Oh, geez. That's not helping me. Are you kidding me? Rhaenyra, Rhaenys, Rhaena.
Yeah, yeah.
God.
A lot of long A sounds in the Targaryen, Valyrian family tree.
Corlys wants Luke to become the Lord of Tides in the fullness of time, but he's like, no, because that means everybody's dead, and I don't want it. Rhaenys comforts her granddaughters, and Rhaenyra makes eyes at Daemon. Aegon gets drunker. Laenor mourns his sister by standing in the sea, and Carl goes to fetch him. And Viserys invites Daemon to return home, but he turns down the offer. And then all the old men and children are sent to bed. And that's kind of the break in this scene here. There's still lots of hot D left to talk about. We'll be right back after the break.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations, while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
And now, back to Hot D.
I want to go back, because I know people will ask about the five dragons in the establishing shot here at high tide. Here's the best that I can, because I thought there would be articles to do all this work for me. And there were, I couldn't find any from, like, which dragon. So, like, I had to make my best guess. I think the first one that we see fly across the first one that flies across the camera is Dreamfire. Now, if you listen to the spoiler segment I did like 2 weeks ago, there is like, you know, there's this lore fascination of where Dany's eggs came from, those three fossilized eggs. Like, how the hell did some urchin and Essos, you know, get a hold of those? Well, Fire and Blood had some clues that there was a female companion wink, wink, a roommate of a Targaryen princess that kind of got in a spurned lover situation and decided to leave because she wanted to go explore the seas. And she's said to have stolen 3 eggs out of the Targaryen hatchery. And in the same chapter, they mentioned that this Dreamfire dragon is this prolific layer of eggs. Like, she's got 3 clutches to her name, which is pretty rare, you know, for dragons to be that prolific. And they just mentioned her laying a clutch of 3 at this lady's home before she does this. So a lot of people speculated Dreamfire is that that the mother of these fossilized eggs. And 2 episodes ago, when we saw this dragon that almost roasted Aemon when he was trying to like go down and explore, mm-hmm. a lot of people noticed that that dragon's model was essentially a reskin of Drogon and his brother, brothers Viserion and Rhaegal. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All the other dragons look distinctively. This thing looks like a spitting image of Drogon. So a lot of people thought Dreamfire, hey, that might be the, you know, that might be confirming this theory. This dragon that cruises in front is one of those dead on clones of Drogon. So I'm going to assume it's Dreamfire. Then the next large dragon in the extreme background is either Syrax or it could be Meraxes. That's I couldn't tell the color from that far away. But that would either be Rhaenyra's dragon or mm-hmm. her, or Rhaenys's dragon. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
Then we see Caraxes in the middle distance, coming from behind the castle, doing his little thing in the air with his weird yeah. legs and stuff.
Daemon's dragon.
Then I think Sea Smoke is the large dragon in the kind of foreground closest to the High Tide Castle, and then I think we actually finally see Sunfire, the sexiest dragon in the Seven Kingdoms, with his golden scales and his pale creamy wings in on the foreground.
Okay.
I think those are all 5 dragons here. And it's interesting, Fire and Blood, they say that during this funeral, Driftmark became like Valeria of old. There's so many dragons. It was like the single largest gathering of dragons the Seven Kingdoms had ever known, because all the Targaryens, Valerians, everybody came there to pay their respects. So I thought it was kind of cool that it did. Place was festooned with dragons.
I wonder what a dragon family reunion looks like.
Probably this.
Well, we don't ever see them like hanging out, right? Where do they go? Do they congregate in one place? Do they spread to the far ends of the island?
They play a little horseshoe, little cornhole, get a couple buckets of KFC.
See who can shoot fire the farthest.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Altitude competitions. It gets crazy. I also want to pay homage or call out Allison's stink eye is mm-hmm. so fucking good in this episode, and she levels some pretty supreme ones at Rhaenyra. Just her look of utter disgust at what's going on here. I was kind of impressed or that they're still sticking with Jace, you know, kind of being out and proud, or, you know, at least to his mother, about knowing who his real father is and regretting that he can't be in Harrenhal. Mm-hmm. That seems could be dangerous.
Yep. Yeah. No, I think that's the whole point.
Yeah.
Kids don't have the concerns that their parents do for these kinds of things.
So as promised, Helena, who is, we think, this dreamer Targaryen, she's saying a whole bunch of crazy shit as she's catching the spider in the shell. I wrote down, she says, hand turns loom, spool of green, spool of black, dragons of flesh weaving dragons of thread. Do you got any ideas of what that might mean?
Dragons of flesh. I want to assume are the Targaryens. Weaving dragons of thread? Lineage? Ravens? Clothes? I have no idea. Dragons of thread.
The green and black seems pretty self-explanatory. You've got the greens are the, you know, loyal to Allison's the family, and the blacks are loyal to Rhaenyra's. But yeah, and then, you know, just like a lot of people thought Helena, you know, her prophecy about Aemond, when Aemond and Alicent are talking about him getting a dragon and Helena mutters that he'll have to close one eye. It seems like that came true. But also, she talked about the last kind of segment of the worm not having any legs. A lot of people thought that might point to Bran. You know, Bran Stark ending up as the last, you know, kind of king in this cycle. I do wonder if, like, what kind of fulfillment we'll see these prophecies have, if any, and if there's any kind of greater, lesser fulfillment. If there's a fulfillment in this time of the Dance of Dragons, and then maybe a greater one in later down the line. But yeah, that's something to keep our eye on
for sure.
What did you think with Laris kind of benevolently mad dogging Alicent here?
He's just psychotic. I mean, this is I don't know what to make of this guy. He clearly seems like he has a screw loose. I look at his smile on the boat later when Alicent's like, yeah, I'm gonna have to call on you for a favor at some point, and he's just, it comes off as unhinged.
That's the thing. I never got him being unhinged until like this episode, you know. He's giving like Jeffrey Dahmer, you know,
like he doesn't have impulse control. Like he's gotten a taste of some kind of importance and some kind of like leverage, and now he just is living on that, right?
Yeah,
just feeding off of that idea that he's now in.
Yeah,
and it's like,
and he's not being subtle about it. Like Christian Cole saying, like, you know, people, it's pretty obvious. People are taking notice. I thought Lucerys was pretty heartbreaking with you know, Corlys, because Corlys is trying to pump him up. It's like, you know, all this is going to be yours one day, little man. And he's like, I didn't want it, because he's a bastard like Jon Snow, and they just instinctively reject their birthright because, you know, they're stand up folk. And he's like, well, it's your birthright, lad. And he's like, well, if I have this, it means everyone else is dead. And like, Corlys is not made of stone. He sees that this is profoundly sad for a child to be thinking about these things. I thought that was a nice little touch of these literally sweet summer children having to face all these terrible things.
Yeah, it's a continuation of parents forcing upon their children things that they wouldn't choose for themselves. It makes you wonder why they even do it this way. Why give the succession to someone who isn't interested in it?
Yeah.
What is the actual importance of blood here? Wouldn't it be more important to give to somebody who actually will do a good job? Although I will say, I think Aemond is gunning for it. You know, if he weren't the second son here, he would be right where in his wheelhouse.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, obviously they're trapped in systems here. It's not like they, well, this kid, he's in line for it, but he doesn't want it. So, you know, like the challenge for a lord would be to like get him ready to take it anyway, because if you just start passing people over willy nilly, the whole idea of succession is to keep civil wars from happening.
Sure.
If you have rules that are followed when everything's kind of going well, that's going to cut down on the amount of ambitious civil wars that you're going to start. You're not going to eliminate them all, because like I said, when things are going bad, why the fuck not roll the dice and try a civil war? But
and when things get complicated in the family tree. Yeah,
exactly. I really like Laenor, you know, really grieving over his sister because he genuinely loved her. I liked Viserys approaching Daemon, and, you know, kind of like, it's his classic funeral. Like, hey, you know, makes you think how precious life is and how much you can waste time easily and regret that. And Daemon's not having any of it. He's like, I don't need anything from you. Don't want anything from you. Fuck you.
Okay, this episode made me think that maybe I'm doing bedtime wrong all my entire life, because it doesn't seem particularly late, and yet everybody seems so interested in getting to bed. And maybe that's a consequence of the day for night shoot, that it doesn't seem late, but it turns from day to night pretty quickly. And
yeah,
did people just go to bed at like 6 p.m. back then?
I think.
And like wake up at 3 a.m. or something?
I think it's, in days before you had electricity, people went to bed kind of earlier, you know, because if you stay up late, you're burning candles, you're burning wood, that's expensive. And like, I also hear told before the Industrial Revolution or Industrial Age that like humans would kind of sleep in two shifts. Like you would like sleep for 4 or 5 hours, and then you'd be up for a half hour, an hour. And I guess that's a lot of time. That's when families would get busy. you know, because like, you know, kids are still asleep and it's like, hey, you know, we're going to be up for next. And then you go asleep for another 3 or 4 hours. So like the nights kind of lasted longer. I don't know. I did think it was weird, although I will say that it seems like everyone thought it was early to be put to bed. You know, yeah. Like Rhaenyra's kids are like, what the fuck? The sun just went down. The old king is the old king. So maybe he goes off to bed just because he's old and cranky and tired.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just thought it was hilarious that the old people and the kids are being put to bed by the vital adults.
Did you have any thoughts about... the other thing is like Otto and Daemon still hate each other. Or at least Daemon does. Otto tries to do the right thing and Daemon calls him a fat leech and says he's hungry for another meal.
Well, does Otto try and do the right thing or is he like sticking it to him? I forget exactly what he says there, but it felt a bit snarky, his comment.
Yeah, because Daemon stuck it to him right after his lady wife had died earlier in the season. So that could be.
Yeah.
But he wasn't being like as grossly insulting about it as Daemon was. And I think that Otto is big on trying to observe the niceties so he can be like, my lord, I tried kissing his ass and then my lips are rejected. I mean, I think that's how I interpreted it. Mm-hmm. And then finally, do you think that Viserys's mind is slipping, or do you think it's more of Aim has been on his mind a lot? We saw him kissing her ring last episode. Like, this is like a fond time that he can remember when he was young and healthy and he had a beautiful wife and the promise of maybe healthy heirs and the family all got together and it's before him and Daemon's big blowouts and he's just nostalgic for that time.
I suppose it could be that. I said in the instant take, I think he might be losing a step, but he's also got a lot on his mind. So yeah, it could just be that. Otherwise, in this episode, he seems pretty with it, I would say.
Yeah.
My other question is here, why doesn't Corlys just go retrieve Laenor himself? I mean, it's his father, for Christ's sake. Go down to the water and get him.
I'm going to confess, I thought that whole interaction was bizarre.
Yeah, why would he want to draw attention to Carl in that moment?
Right. Yeah, maybe he's like, Carl, like, if you're going to be my son's lover, the least you can do is like keep him on, you know, the respectable path here. I thought it was wild. And like even his brother, Vaemond, was kind of like, the hell are you doing? You know, like you're going to blow up his spot. But like your son is grieving over his sister. Mm-hmm. Maybe he should be there comforting his quote unquote children. But like, why don't you as your dad go down there and fetch him? I thought that was a bizarre reaction for Corlys to have.
Yeah, and it doesn't seem to have much of an effect on the rest of the episode, so I don't know why they did it, but
no,
that's fine. Speaking of
Corlys, let me ask you this, why Daemon and Viserys's exchange here is fresh in her mind. Let me ask you this, what do you think that Viserys thinks? What do you think about what Viserys thinks about what Daemon and Rhaenyra got married? Do you think he's supportive of that? Do you think, and do you think that Daemon spurring his kind of like feelers for reconciliation, how do you think that impacted how he may or may not feel?
So it doesn't change the heir to be situation, right? Like, so she is the heir. She still has these kids by Harwin that people are still going to call bastards. She could have kids with Daemon, but they won't be the heir, right?
No, they're like Jace third in the line behind, you know, Jace, Luke, and Joff.
Yeah, so I don't know that like this clears the air on that stuff. So it seems just like an insane thing to do. And I do wonder if he'll suspect that they had something to do with Laenor's death, like the rest of the realm probably will, you know, as they talk about. In that case, I don't think he... I don't know. I'm not sure how much he cares even at this point about that detail, because they've got bigger fish to fry and they've already got heirs and the situation is already so messed up. Like, adding a Daemon to the equation doesn't really change things much in my mind. But I could be totally wrong. The realm has some weird views on things sometimes.
Yeah,
and the king.
Yeah, I'm curious because they just kind of do it and we don't get the reaction, the immediate reaction to that. I'm curious to see how people interpret that, whether they're under suspicion for Laenor's death, because it does seem like they did a pretty good job of establishing, you know, They had a loud argument. They had a lover's quarrel. It turned to violence. There was witnesses there that, you know, Damon didn't do it. It was Carl, his crazy gay lover. So I wonder if there will be any suspicions.
I think Allison is the more likely to be super suspicious because of what she knew about Damon and Rhaenyra when Rhaenyra was a teenager and the lies she told Allison.
God, it's just another horrible thing that Rhaenyra has done in a long line of horrible things in Allison's mind.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, as much as she has influence over Viserys, which is dwindling, I think, after the stunts in this episode.
Yeah.
She'll be able to kind of convince him that that's true, but I don't know if he's going to listen to her, because I'm not sure they're ever going to talk again. He might go to his deathbed just never having a real conversation with Allison again.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, let's go over to Rhaenys and Corlys. She gets him to admit that his desire to define his legacy is what's driving his actions, not desire to see wrongs righted. Rhaenys uses that desire for legacy to try to convince Corlys to leave Driftmark to Baela. Unfortunately, he believes the blood doesn't matter to legacy, only names matter.
He's probably right. The 200 years from now, they will just talk about the Valyrians having this or the Valyrians having that. It won't be, you know, there'll be the gossip and all that. But that's probably a tale of mushroom, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Yeah.
He's probably right.
Prove any of that stuff. And as long as the people in power insist that it's been done properly and rightly, then who's to defy them? You know, and if they get defied, well, they're probably all dead anyway, so who cares?
I do think it's interesting because, like, we began the series with the idea that Rhaenyra and Corlys are kind of united in this feeling of spurned, you know, this feeling that they got passed over, these hurt feelings. But
yeah, that's changed.
Rhaenys says, and I believe her, that, you know, actually, I've gotten over this. It's your pride and your ambition that's keeping this thing going. And look, it's costing us our children. And by God, by the end of this episode, her reaction to finding Laenor dead is just, you wonder whether it's going to drive a wedge in between these two, who have so far been like the thickest of thieves, of married thieves.
How
will it affect their loyalties to which side of what family?
Yeah, very good questions. I'm not 100% sure I understand Rhaenys' side of this, because she very much lays the blame here for her children's death on Corlys. And I don't see the direct path. I see a roundabout path of like, yeah, you got involved with marriage to all these lords who have all their drama and it's getting our kids killed. But like, he didn't have anything to do with Laena getting killed. Like, as best I can tell, there, unless like he was really pushing hard, and we never see it, but if he was pushing hard for Damon to marry Laena, and knowing kind of Damon's a wild card, but honestly, Damon didn't even have anything to do with her dying.
It seemed like, if anything, Laena was the one that was, you know, wanting to couple up with Damon because he's just so fucking awesome.
Right. And but Rhaenys is laying that blame at Corlys' feet, and I don't think it's deserved in this scene.
But what she's saying is, in any other circumstance, our true children would inherit these things. And now we've got these cuckoos that are essentially taking it over. So I think she's talking about costing her children.
Because Laenor.
Yeah, in the case of their, like she says, like, this is our legacy. You're going to give this away to bastard children when you've got, you know, true-born heirs that still have the Valyrian blood coursing through them. And
sure.
And also, like, I think she's echoing what this high priest was saying, that, like, you know, we got to keep our bloodline. Like, it seems like the sentiment on Driftmark is like, Driftmark for Valyrians and fuck them fake ass Targaryens, you know?
Yeah, it takes a very precise sword to the flimsy cover that Corlys has been using to say that he loves his family, when really what he wants is his legacy. If he's willing to abandon his bloodline in favor of the name that history will remember, yeah, that's pretty obvious. So she does a great job, poking holes in that. And I love her just saying, look, we're alone, just speak plainly here.
Right.
These are bastards, right? None of these kids are actually ours.
I want to think that you're not stupid. Can you tell me so I know That, yeah. I thought that was really good. And also, before we move on, I just want to show, like, take note how well lit this scene is, which is an interior scene in darkness, and you can see the firelight on people's faces and the candlelight on playing over to things, and how everything is like, damn, you know, this was 100% artificially shot, and it looks great. It looks, it's very recognizably dark, but everything's, compare and contrast that to the previous scene.
And this next one. Unfortunately, we're about to have Rhaenyra and Daemon walking on the beach, talking about their romantic relationships, both the living and the dead, and they kiss, and then they go to some place on the beach a little more private.
Yeah, have some sand sex. Always fun.
Yeah, they're banging in the sand. That's terrible.
I think this is a shipwreck that they're fucking in. It's like, you know, when the hull of the ship turned upside down because it looked like the bones of the frame of the ship with maybe some old sails kind of draped over it. So you get like
some netting, maybe
cabana type of private cabana type of effect.
Yeah. Yeah. I was fortunate to find that on the beach, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, beaches this is a pretty treacherous bay, the Blackwater. So like, there's no small amount of shipwrecks that would come up on shore. And what the hell are you gonna do? You're gonna dredge every shipwreck off of your beach? I don't know.
And you can't use them all to make thrones. You only need one throne, maybe two, if you're building castles, multiple castles.
Yeah, you want a backup one at Driftmark.
Mm-hmm.
I like how this filled in a lot of things that people were complaining about like, oh, how do we know how people feel about, you know, that there was. You know, there is some genuine love and affection between Laenor and Rhaenyra. That they did try. You know, they weren't just like completely foolish. They did try, and maybe Laenor's got some clogged up pipes or something. And that, you know, Harwin. I thought it was interesting how she talked about Harwin, that he was quite devoted to her, and her response is, "I trusted him." So like, I don't think. And I don't think there was no love there, but like, I think you're supposed to understand that kind of Rhaenyra all this time has kind of, and far of real love, multidimensional love, has kind of only had eyes for Daemon and felt very betrayed on the multiple occasions where he kind of got her buttered up and then turned left her, like first at the brothel and then at her wedding when, you know, he grabs her and looks like he's going to kiss her and take her, and then he just fucks off and has never, like, I think you're supposed to understand he's never been seen again in King's Landing. Yeah, he just went over to Essos with his new bride. Yeah. Didn't check on her. Didn't be like, hey, niece, how you doing? Is it rough over here? Just stayed the hell away. And from his perspective, he thought, you know, contrary to what the showrunners were telling us, it wasn't necessarily impotence. It's just like, I was trying to protect you, you know, from me.
Sure.
So, yeah, I thought all that. And then this all the, you know, and she said something about, you could have spared me from the droll tragedy my life has become. And
well, mine's not great either. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they were happy enough. I thought this was a really, really good scene. If you could make out in the darkness,
right.
There's some really good acting and some well-written dialogue here.
And then Rhaenyra, you know, making her move. She says, "I'm no longer a child," and I'm like, "I'm Daemon here. Cool. Are you still my niece?" Because that's weird. But no, Daemon doesn't care about that.
Not Targaryens.
And then they play the romantic strings, like I said, in the instant take. I'm still grossed out. Yeah, she's no longer a child, but she is still his niece, and he's still her uncle. But we're just going to gloss right over that because the show does too.
Yeah, I don't give a fuck about Targaryen incest. I'm tired of pretending. I'm like the Joker on Robert De Niro's, you know, it's like, yeah, whatever, man.
Sure. All right, let's go over to Aemon making his way out to where Vhagar is sleeping and trying to ride her. It's touch and go for a bit, but he eventually gets permission to climb on board. Vhagar takes off, almost throwing Aemond, but he manages to hang on. And Baela and her sister see this from their window, and they wake Jace to alert him that someone stole Vhagar. We'll take a quick break right there.
There's still lots of hot D to talk about. We'll be back right after the break. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car?
The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
And now back to Hot D.
I like seeing the saddle. I was wondering which dragon this was, and as soon as we saw the very ropey seaweed like saddle, I'm like, okay, this is Vhagar, because I don't recognize dragons by faces. I'm sorry, I've got face blindness when it comes to dragons.
They all look the same. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was excited, and that's one of the reasons why when people were writing in about, oh, I can't believe we didn't get to see this little girl claim the biggest, baddest dragon of all time. It's like, really had to bite my tongue, because it, you know, you can't do that, right? You can't show the same scene essentially two episodes apart. And this is the more important, impactful scene. Yeah, I thought it was great. Again, it was pretty much how it happened in the book. Their location was different, and like the order of the scuffle happening, and you know, the girls being there, and then the ones that kind of alerting the boys. But it all kind of went down as it went in the book, and I thought it was really well done. Mm-hmm. I really admired the cojones on Aemond here. Like, he really sells this kid. It's like, I'm gonna get this dragon or die trying. I'm tired of my brothers and my cousins clowning me and this pig shit. I'm going to redeem myself by getting the biggest, baddest dragon of the land or die trying. And I thought it was great.
Yeah. And you snooze, you lose, Bela. Should have got there first.
He's a combination of his Targaryen blood, a smattering of High Valyrian, and the patented Chris Pratt, you know, Velociraptor training hand position. You know, he had his right hand out there stretched. Hey, Doharis, I see you, mm-hmm. Blue.
Blue hand. Gives him the blue hand.
Gave him the blue hand, yeah. I thought it was great. And again, the flying stuff, I thought that was really thrilling and exciting. You know, it's very Harry Potter riding Hippogriff, but, you know, they hit all the marks, like them trying to flung him off, and how it's kind of scary and terrifying at first, but then he gets mastery, and now he's doing the slow glide over to sea, and Vhagar's dipping her wings in, and it's really cool. But it's just like, man, just like everything about the way they animated this dragon, like her rising up and shaking off the sand, and just lumbering like these big heavy footsteps and taking to the air. It just, yeah, it felt like this kid just threw his legs over 747.
Yeah, and I can almost hear Vhagar say, all right, kid, if you want to do this, we're going to do it all the way. And then just launching.
Right.
It's great. Yeah. And then those bird strikes potential were very scary.
Very good.
Dodging that stuff.
Yeah, and he's just like in the very beginning when she's like doing these dives and loops, he's just kind of ragdolling in the saddle. He's holding on by the reins, mm-hmm. by like his pinkies, and it's good. It's just badass. And you know, we talked a little shit about their shoddy dragon work in the earlier part of the season as far as the riding and the saddles and all that kind of stuff, but man, they just fucking nailed it here. Everything came together.
Yeah. It was not bad. I will say that I don't know if I need to say this, but maybe some people aren't getting this from the scene, but this is like a permanent bond thing, you know, with the dragon. So like the idea that he climbs aboard and takes it for a ride kind of means Bela can't. And that's why she's so upset in the next scene. And that's why it could be important to whatever conflicts are to come. Right. And why Otto goes, actually it was worth getting a dragon, trading an eye. I struggle to think that this is like entirely positive for them, because at the same time that they're gaining a dragon, it feels like they're alienating Aegon even more. Aegon doesn't want this, the throne. He's not preparing himself for it. And then his brother is like throwing him under the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. It feels like he's
one
up
him on the dragon scale. Yeah.
And is like getting closer to his mother than Aegon is. And I feel like Aegon is. They don't come right out and say it, but it's creating a situation where I could see Aegon getting disillusioned with his family.
And there's already kind of a rift between him and Aemond anyway. He was like the leader of the bully squad, you know, the pink.
Yeah, the pig. Dread. Yeah.
The pink dread. So like there could be a surprising split in the greens there. That's mildly interesting.
Okay. Yeah, I guess that's all you can say there.
Uh-huh.
I do see maybe some animosity building. We'll see how that works out. Anyways, Aemond lands Vhagar and he's confronted by Lena and Rhaenyra's children. They're pissed that he stole the dragon that was supposed to be Baela's. Aemond is kicking the shit out of the kids until he calls them bastards, and then Jace pulls a knife, which, you know, he doesn't use to great success, but Luke grabs it and cuts open Aemond's face. And then the Kingsguard shows up and puts an end to the violence.
Yeah, I wonder if they're suggesting that Sir Criston Cole has done a lot better job of training Allison's boys to fight, because Aemond handles these kids. Mm-hmm. Like they are, and until they get lucky with the pocket sand knife combo, he's probably going to kill one of them. And he's threatening them with death. He's like, you're going to die screaming in fire just like your father, you bastards. And he raises a rock like he's going to kill Jacaerys. And it's bad. And then Harold Westerling, you know, arrives just in time to essentially not do a damn thing. A lot of people had questions about, like, why aren't the dragons guarded? I think you're supposed to understand that, like, you can't steal a dragon, let alone Vhagar. They're not just like, you know, again, the Targaryens believe that only they can control a dragon. So there's not that many vacant dragon riders. And I'm probably assume if you ask Viserys, he's like, well, yeah, probably one of Lena's kids will claim it. Whoever doesn't have the dragon, Rhaena, well, she'll probably claim it.
Oh, is it so Rhaena? Like it's not Baela. Okay.
I think Baela's the older one. I could be wrong there. So in the books, they're supposed to be twins. I don't think that's true in the show. I don't think these children are twins. It looks like one is about 2 years older.
Well, based on what Rhaena said about Driftmark going to Baela, I think Baela is the older. Yeah. So you're right.
Yeah. It would be Rhaena. Yeah. Maybe she's just really dismantling the system. She's not only skipping the male heir, she's skipping. Yeah, I'm gonna do the second daughter. What do you think about that? What do you think about that?
I don't think so. But
yeah, it's like you can't like really steal, especially maybe you can steal a hatchling. You could definitely steal an egg, but you're gonna steal Vhagar, man.
That's crazy. Yeah,
some random dude from Essos is gonna come up on this fucking giant sky dragon, and gonna happen.
Maybe another dragon rider climbs on board, parks Vhagar in a dragon garage. I don't know.
And then the other thing is like the kids. I just can't get mad at a show that, first of all, it just happens just like in the books. Like the kids, like, you know, Aemon got up in the dead of night to do this. Luke has said he was an early riser and he likes to go fuck with his dragon first thing in the morning because he's got a little dragon of his own and he catches him. And, you know, then he alerts his brother and everything kind of happens just like that. It's like the idea that the royal family can get out of bed, you know, if they're supposed to be in bed and like kind of undetected around a highborn's castle. That's not super, like, I don't think anyone thought that there was a threat here. You know, there wouldn't be like a high, you know, this is on a high tide, a stronghold of Valyrians and the Targaryens, and it's all family and it's for a few. Like, I really don't think that, you know, they were aware that the cousins would try to cousins, nephews would try to murder each other. So I didn't have a problem with that.
Also, there may be hidden tunnels in this castle as well. You know, I mean, we've seen two now that most likely have them, definitely in King's Landing, but perhaps in... oh boy, what's the strong castle?
Oh, Harrenhal.
In Harrenhal, yeah. There almost certainly were some secret tunnels in there for the assassins to get into. I think Harren
the Black would probably have a couple secret tunnels, and Corlys is a shifty kind of pirate dude. He might have some back ways, back entrances.
So who knows? There's a million ways they could have gotten out and snuck out, but yes, kids do this. I don't know if you were ever a kid, Aaron, but I was, and I did this stuff. So
plus, there's only seven Kingsguard. Like, there are the king, the queen, Rhaenyra, the prince, the heir, the princess.
Yeah,
you've got six princes and two princesses. Like, there's just not enough to go around. So.
Yeah,
them all getting up in the dead of night when everything was supposed to be all quiet. And plus, the Kingsguard are going to sleep too. You understand, right? They're seven dudes. They're just people. They're not like immortal thing. Yeah.
So at any given time, maybe three, four of them awake
on a night watch. And this kind, maybe just two. So, or maybe just one, because they talk about like you've got the night watch, etc. So, like, I didn't have a big problem with this. This isn't like they're out about in the open or in some place that they would think that they'd be in danger.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't think there was much danger when I went into this scene. I'm like, kid fight. This is kind of, it is almost cute, right? These kids but then, you know, Aemon starts throwing punches on these little girls. I'm like, oh, well, okay. I'm sitting up. And then he gets stabbed in the face. Knives come out. I'm like, all right. That was a serious fight.
Yeah, when Bela laid him out, I'm like, oh, fuck yeah. But then when he got up and just gave it right back to her, I'm like, holy, yeah. And like all four of them were on him at one point, and he fought them all off. He's like fucking Neo in the Burly Brawl against Agent Smith. So it's like, he can't be stopped.
Totally. All right. Well, if the kid fight was bad, the adult fight is way worse. When everyone's brought together, it comes out that Aemon called Jace a bastard. Viserys demands to know where they heard it, and Aegon says, look, everybody knows, just take a look at him. Alicent demands the eye for an eye punishment, but Viserys is unwilling to do it, so Alicent rushes Rhaenyra with the king's dagger. Rhaenyra gets cut, but it goes no further after Aemon says, I'm happy with the eye for a dragon exchange. Whew. It is a crazy scene, man.
It's very, you know, very reminiscent of King Robert trying to get to the bottom of who bit who and who started what, and then the Nymeria versus Joff versus Arya fight from
way more
from
off
season
the rails.
One. But it, yeah, because like, you know, King Viserys's silence is not nearly as strong as Bobby B's.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I just think it's funny because like Viserys here has to finally confront the reality of what's in front of him, because his son is like, dad, look at these strong children.
And yet he manages to not confront it at the same time, right? It's thrown in his face in front of everyone, and yet he still turns a blind eye to it.
Yeah, like in the book, he demands them make nice and make expressions of love and fraternity, and they do. But here they don't even bother to even, they don't, like, he says all that, but he turns his back, starts to walk away before he enforces it. And then his queen draws a dagger and tries to kill his heir, his only born and his heir. Yeah. And he stills, like, you know, he's got this kind of like weak, we're supposed to be family. It's wild. What did you think of Sir Criston Cole's behavior here? And what did you think that, I guess, the Lord Commander thought of it?
Because I think he played everything just right. And the Lord Commander sees that.
Yeah. I kind of feel like that Sir Criston Cole is kind of like Sir Jaime Lannister, where, like, the other Kingsguard, you know, like, you've done something beyond the pale, and we're never really going to trust you, but we also are not the king or queen, so we can't dismiss you. Mm-hmm. I think that's how Sir Barristan felt about Jaime. It's like, well, you're technically a Kingsguard, even though you're a fucking King Slayer, you piece of shit, and I can't dismiss you because it's not my job, but you know, I'm going to keep my eye on you. And I felt like,
oh, definitely,
Sir Harold was like,
step out of line, but
yeah, like, Cole, fuck Cole, you know, like, don't fucking do it.
And what does he do if he does make a move here? Like,
I think the only one in this room that could do anything is the king. And like, I think Sir Harold would try to cut Cole down if he took another step towards the princess, for sure. Or the princes. He'd have to.
Yeah, and Viserys does say essentially belay that order, right? Like, when Kristen's challenged to go do something about this, cut this child's eye out, Viserys is like, no, don't do that.
And even Kristen, I think, knows that this is crazy, because like when the queen puts it right to him, he's like, yeah, he's like, are you mine or not? And he's like, well, I am your protector, but this is not really protecting.
Yeah.
But even then, Sir Kristen does kind of like, I like the, you know, like Daemon stepping to him is like, you know, like, son, just don't. He Captain America's him. And gosh,
it was super dramatic, because when she said, Kristen, bring me that kid's eye, I'm like, oh, no, this is going to go so. And I'm also like super excited because I want to see him and Harold, whatever his name is, go at it. The Lord Commander.
Yeah.
I would love to see that fight. It feels like it's a little too early for that fight, though. But that fight's got to come, right? They're setting it up so hard.
It's mildly interesting, but I got to say, I kind of want to see, I want to see a lot of these guys square off. I really
hate
this.
This is like a mountain and a viper kind of thing, man. I'm itching to see them go at it.
Yep, yep. But you also see how, like, Alicent here is, I think for the first time you understand there's a lot of jealousy here. Because you remember her and Alice, or her and Rhaenyra growing up, they all oohed and aahed over to pretty princesses, and they all dreamed about the, you know, winning the knight's favor, and like they had these fantasies of marrying these good looking. And like Rhaenyra's done whatever the hell she's wanted. She's fucked the good looking Sir Criston Cole, the very handsome Harwin Strong. Rhaenyra probably thinks she fucked her own uncle. I mean, Alicent did, and Alicent gets sold off to this decrepit crypt keeper.
Yeah, this rotting
and been
carcass
stuck
of a
doing
man.
This thing. It's like, I think there's just naked jealousy on top of the other, the betrayals, and there's this baseline of just like, God damn it, you're trampling over everything. There's this line where she's like, you're trampling over all the duty and sacrifice and honor with your pretty little feet.
I mean, it goes all the way back to there. It goes back to, you know, Rhaenyra kind of bucking against being told who she can marry, right? Like trying to sell her off to fucking Jason Lannister.
Yeah.
And she's like, nah, that's not happening.
Plus, when she draws the fucking dagger of fate and they show that blade and Rhaenyra looks at it, it's like, I also think you're supposed to understand that she's like, damn, you don't even know the burdens I'm carrying.
Oh, sure.
You know, you're talking about duty, and I'm like, I've got this ultimate duty that like maybe I'm not paying strict attention to, and I'm not taking very seriously right now, but like I've got some shit laid on me too, and look at your cloak of righteousness, and now people see how fucking nuts you are. It's a great scene. It's a great
Alicent
scene.
Just needs a concubine, right? Alicent just needs to get laid by somebody who actually wants to get laid by.
Yeah, Sir Criston Cole probably needs to take one for the team and muddy up his cloak again.
Yes,
because
come on, Criston.
Yeah, if she could. And the thing is I think that what I understand about Rhaenyra is Alicent. I don't know why I'm getting this confused. I don't know why Alicent doesn't see that she could break just as many rules. She could get away with fucking behind the king's back as long as she's discreet about it.
The king doesn't actually care that much about her, right? He's obsessed
with
Aemma still.
Looks what she gets away with here. She assaults the heir. She draws royal blood. She does like she runs it down to her dad. She's like, I was this, I was that, I was out of control, I was and Otto's like, yeah, all that stuff. So like, and yet she's gonna be forgiven. So a lot of these things are just, you know, instead of being morally outraged with Rhaenyra, if she'd be like, hey, so can you show me how these tunnels work so I can go get a little on the side too? And they could probably just be the best of slutty pals. But no, Alicent thinks it's got to be the one way and has just suppressed and, you know, deadened everything inside her that she dreamed about as a little girl because of what she thought her duty and obligations are supposed to be.
Yeah. And you see, you know, how Otto pushed her into that. If she had made different decisions when she was a teenager to not go along with this plan, maybe things turn out differently. You know, if she never goes to Viserys to try and comfort him after Aemma's death, her life is a lot different. Her dad is probably more pissed at her, but boy, she'd be in a world of a different situation. Also, I think the other thing that we have to remember in this scene is that Alicent has, I don't know if they specifically say this or if it's something that I picked up on, but she has cloaked herself in righteousness. Actually, I think Rhaenyra says it later in the episode. Yeah. She's super invested in that image. I think if she were to just say, you know what, I'm going to live the Rhaenyra life and I'm going to go sleep around and fuck Kristen and whatever, that would be hugely risky for that image. And I don't think she would take that option. So she probably feels like she's in too deep with her own personal image, right?
Yeah, I meant like if they did this back when they were still teenagers.
Yeah, right.
But like, yeah, totally. At this point, there's been too much. She's invested way too much into that, her sacrifice and duty. You know?
Yes.
She sacrificed her maidenhood to this decrepit monster, and all she's got is a couple janky kids out of it.
Well, before, I also want to point out something else that I noticed on subsequent watches.
Yeah.
Sir Christian retrieves this Valyrian steel dagger and doesn't give it back to either the king or the princess.
Oh. Interesting.
Make anything of that? Do you think that there's a change of hands here? Is that significant?
I didn't realize that, but why? I guess we know that blade finds its way out of the royal lineage. But I mean, with what I think is coming here, like that could happen any number of ways.
Yeah. But
I guess that could be significant.
Yeah, because like I think the chain of custody is Littlefinger had it, and then he lost it to Tyrion in a bet, and then Joffrey stole it. I think somebody gave it to Robert, and then Joffrey stole it to give it to the cat's paw because he thought he was, you know, doing his dad's will and having Bran killed. So, yeah, at some point the Targaryens lose. Of course, they lose everything during the rebellion.
Right. But, that's the thing. Does any of this really matter along the way?
They're making this dagger be like a big thing. Like if there
kills the Night King or whatever. So
if this continues to be a thing and they continue to do Targaryen stories, I wonder if this dagger is going to be like the R2-D2 of this sequence,
sure,
where it's just the thing that keeps showing up and kind of gives you continuity between everything.
That would make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
With where we know that this heads. So next up, Otto tells Alicent that attacking the king's heir with a dagger is exactly the kind of moxie she needs to play the Game of Thrones. And now they have another dragon. There's still lots of hot D left to talk about. We'll be right back after the break. And now, back to hot D.
You know what this scene really reminded me of?
Uh-huh.
It's the scene in We Own This City, where John Bernthal gets called into the carpet for the very first time.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like gulping, like, oh God, this is it. This is my career. Jeez, and they just like end up essentially giving him an attaboy for brutalizing all these civilians.
Yes.
And then he's like, oh fuck, I thought I was getting away with something, or maybe getting like, but now it's just like, it's okay. I think the exact same things happen with Alicent, where, you know, you can tell she's uncomfortable with Larys's, you know, larrying around, and she's uncomfortable with her behavior and how she's, but like now her dad's like, oh, this is exactly the kind of shit you need to pull. And then she cozies even further up with Larys. We just might see Alicent unchained. I've heard of Alice in chains, but now we've got Alicent unchained. Heyo.
Yep.
That's a joke that's about 30 years too late.
You're right, but there's also some danger in this too, right? Because all of the things that Alicent says about what a big fuck up this is, Otto agrees are entirely true. And the price they paid is still going to be a price they pay, with a bunch of people talking about Alicent's lost her damn mind. She's coming at the air with knives. She's losing it, but it's worth the dragon. It's worth it for the dragon.
It's a great line too. It's pretty much like this scene is pretty much straight from the books, even down to Aemon accusing Aegon and Aegon being like, come on, dad. It's a fair trade. I'd trade an eye for a dragon. I'd do that, you know, every day of the week.
You can only do that twice. I hate to tell you. You get to Tuesday and you're pretty much
done
with
that.
But
if you could, if you had more eyes, you'd do that trade, you know.
You could trade a few Aegon eyes.
You're right. Maybe you stick with one eye for one dragon. Because you lose two. Has there ever been a blind dragon rider? I don't know.
If they have a psychic link, it shouldn't matter. The dragon can be their eyes. I don't know. I mean, yeah, you, or maybe you take one from each child, right? You can get, is it Helena? I don't know. With one of her eyes, take that eye, trade that for a dragon. Yeah, you get three dragons in this family.
I do say that we actually have a fan, a blind fan, whose handle is Dragon Walker. So you could be a blind Dragon Walker. I don't know if you could be a blind dragon rider. I don't know if Dragon Walker gets a kick out of that or not, but
it's a shout out anyway. For sure.
I see you over there. Oh, I'm taunting her. I'm taunting her with my sighted eyes. Oh, my God.
Oh, God.
Get me out of here before I get in more trouble, Jim.
All right, let's move on. Lenor returns to find his entire family beaten and bloodied. It's pretty crazy scene when he walks in. Rhaenyra sends away the kids and they talk about the bastard issue. Lenor recommits himself to Rhaenyra and her children. And we kind of end the scene there. The scene that he shows up to, man, he's got to just be like, what happened while I was gone?
Yeah.
Rhaenyra's getting stitched up. Luke just looks like shit.
It's like that.
Jace.
Yeah, it's like that, you know, community scene where Donald Glover goes to get the pizza and he comes back and literally everything is on fire and he's just staring aghast. I thought it was a good line from Rhaenyra where she says, he says, oh, I wish I'd been there. And he's like, that should have been our house words. You know, I should have been there.
Yeah.
Because he keeps clever. And it's so very much like him coming in for the latest birth. Where he's like, oh, did I miss everything? Was it hard? Was it too much pain? What was the damages? And he's just always a little bit a day late and a dollar short.
Yeah, doing the bare minimum, helping her walk up to the queen's chambers, right? It's like he's there for kind of the easy stuff. His line about Valyrian steel cuts clean. The maester says that. Unlike the Dornish steel, which cuts jagged as shit, it just like it tears you up. You make one slip with a kitchen knife in Dorne, you're done. You're never gonna heal that wound.
Yeah, that surgical steel that the doctors use nowadays is like a chainsaw compared to Valyrian steel. I thought it was funny because he's like, oh, the Valyrian steel cuts clean, and that's good because I stitch so dirty. I need if there's any doctors out there to want to like give a 1 to 10 for these mate, because I just feel like they're doing these big Frankenstein stitches, man. And this is for the royal family. Like you're some baseborn bastard in Fleabottom. What the hell? Did they just kind of like, I don't know, they just super glue
it? Cut it off. Yeah.
Yeah. They just get an amputation. Mm-hmm. It's tough, but I do also like, I really like this scene. This is when a few times you see adult Rhaenyra smile openly like she did when she was a child, you know, when Laenor's really like getting down on himself and it's like, I hate the gods for making me as they did. And she's like, no, you're an honorable man. You're a good man. Mm-hmm. It's rare. And we tried to do our duty while still exploring happiness. And I also like the fact that, like, you know, this is, again, another dollar, a day late and a dollar short, but like, hey, I'm with you now. I'm going to do whatever's necessary for the realm. I'm going to make these kids princes. I'm going to be your dutiful husband. I'm done chasing the tail. I don't know if he would stick to that, you know, 3, 6 months, a year, a couple years down the line. But I think he says it and he means it. And it makes Rhaenyra really thoughtful about, you know, she's like, you deserve a husband, even fully committed. And I thought there was, she gets this like kind of like far away look in her eyes when he says you deserve a husband. And I think she starts doing the math as like, even if you do 110% of Lenor, it's still not going to be enough. It's still not what I need in this position. And she starts instantly thinking Daemon.
Yeah, no, this idea of duty and happiness not being able to mutually exist, I think is weighing on all of them at this point. Because they thought they could have it all, right? When they were kids, they were like, yeah, we'll get married and I'll sleep with who I want to sleep with. You can sleep with who you want to sleep with and we'll have heirs and everything will be fine. Nah, it's not working out that way.
Yeah, and the way Rhaenyra talks about, you know, her droll tragedy, it's too bad that Alicent can't see into, because like, man, Rhaenyra is really taking it to the crotch the last couple episodes, you know, her paramour dies and, you know, her dad's real sick and the realm's all talking about like, this. I think Alicent sees Rhaenyra as like having it all, like proverbially eating the cake and still possessing the cake. Mm-hmm. But from Rhaenyra's perspective, she's eating a lot of cake, but man, there ain't a lot of cake left.
Yeah.
She's really giving away the cake, the cake store.
Yeah, putting that final piece in the freezer for like 15 years from now,
and then she goes back and it's freezer burnt. It's just not, mm-hmm. Yeah, it didn't keep in the freezer like she thought it would.
Power went out. You forgot to check it. You forgot to put it in the ice bucket. Yeah, now it's done.
Yep. Right. The cake metaphor has been strained and stretched. We need a maester in here to ugly stitch it up.
All right, let's move on. On the boat back to King's Landing, Alicent tries to talk to Viserys about what happened, but he never wants to talk about it again.
Boy, this whole trip took a lot out of him, because we talked about,
yes.
And the book, I was rereading it this morning, the relevant passages, and they point out that when they switched to the younger maester, that his treatment seemed to agree with the king more than the leechings, and the king kind of has a bounce back to health. But we're seeing the limits of that, because I feel like this mm-hmm. whole experience but the Daemon, the hostility from the Valyrians, the hostility in his own family, like it feels like it just drained him. And he's now kind of like regressed to 3 episodes ago where he's kind of near swoon.
This feels like a return to, I mean, these types of events drain Viserys, you know, when there is conflict, when there is drama within his family, like look back at the wedding, right? He collapses twice. At Laenor and Rhaenyra's wedding feast. I feel like this is, you know, equally as traumatic, if not more. His wife coming at his daughter with a knife. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's just how he reacts. It takes a lot out of him. But here, this thing is, like Otto says earlier, like in time he will forgive you. What choice does he have? This is not forgiveness. And I don't know if they're ever going to have an honest conversation again. He's looking worse for wear at the end of this, mm-hmm. and time is not on his side. And this is not forgiveness. This is ignoring the issue.
Yeah, depending on how long, I guess that's the question that I'm having going forward is like, mm-hmm. how much longer does Viserys have?
Yeah,
he's definitely had a return
to forgive her.
He's definitely had, you know, the younger maester came in there, stepped in and seemed like he saved the day and has given him a new lease on life. But by the end of this episode, he's back to looking very weak, very frail.
Mm-hmm. And I think the one place where Otto.
How much time does the king have to forgive, to come to a full forgiveness of of Alicent?
Yeah, no, probably not a ton. I think Otto saying, well, he'll forgive you eventually. I think the time has passed for pouring the honey into the king's ear, right? I don't know that there's much more that Alicent can do. So losing him, his favor is probably not the biggest deal in the world, right? He's never going to go, like, take the extra steps of, like, disavowing, disowning her,
banishing her. Yeah, putting her head on a spike, yeah.
But she's lost the opportunity to whisper into his ear. But it's not a big deal.
I'm not so sure, because like the him saying let's speak no more of it honestly is less hot than I thought he'd be the next day.
Yeah.
Like that's like, you know, not getting to like, let's just like let bygones. That's pretty huge for like you stabbed my daughter and tried to pluck out one of my grandson's eyes.
But it's forget, not forgive for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like I said, I don't know that it matters with as little time as he has left with the state of the board. I'm not sure. Being able to whisper into Viserys' ear actually matters at this point.
Gotcha.
Rhaenyra and Daemon talk briefly. Rhaenyra believes fire is a prison and the sea offers an escape. They talk about the different philosophies of Valyrian's house versus Targaryen's.
On subsequent watches, it's very obvious what's happening here. You know, she's saying the sea is an escape, not a death sentence. So
yes, beginning
a close
of her
watch on
plan.
First one, you'd start kind of like, because again, I was caught flat footed at his survival.
Oh, yeah.
So
I think everyone was.
Yeah. I wondered like if that would be more, you would be more keen to be on it if you were not a book reader, knowing that like, you know, thinking that like, oh, yeah, he gets murdered. The only question is like what was the motive and who did it, and if it was more than it seemed on the surface. But his survival, now that I looked at all the different ways they coded it and how they shot it, it's like, oh, they murder some random black guy,
And we never really see Laenor fall into the fire. We just see an unrecognizable corpse. And like if you people would cotton onto it before they actually see his shaven head and be like, classic Targaryen incognito mode, bald head. Yeah.
right. And the sort of double entendre way she's speaking, right? Not sexually, but like her words have various meanings depending on what you think she's about to do, kill him or send him off. So it's all there. It all tracks, which makes it so good on a second watch. But I was not picking up on it on first watch at all.
Yeah.
But I think this is definitely where she starts to formulate the plan. And I think she has got to feel like she wants to get Laenor out of this, right? It's not just like, well, I want to be able to marry Daemon and we got to get him out of the picture. It's more like I brought this kind-hearted, honorable man into this bullshit.
Yeah.
And I want to get him out before he just gets destroyed by it.
Yeah, I agree. And that's why I also was effective as a book reader, I'm knowing what was coming. I'm like, oh my God, it's one thing to kill this guy or have Daemon do it to grease the wheels. But like you, after this man said he was going to do all this sacrifice and come correct. And you've already talked about how amazing a guy is.
The other reason that works so well is because that's very Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
For somebody like profess, so, I'm on the straight and narrow now, and then off with their head.
I'm like, damn, the princess and the queen have just broken fucking bad this episode.
Yeah. They want people to think they have.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's go over to Laris. Laris offers to take Jace's eye if Alicent wishes. She doesn't, but she says, hey, I might come calling for a favor at some point, so be ready. He comes hobbling up and I'm just like, not now, Laris. Jesus Christ. Did you not hear about what happened back there? I'm in no mood.
Yeah, have we made this comparison of Alicent to Cersei yet? Because I really felt it this episode, the way she is sidling up to all these unsavory characters because she feels like she needs political alliances and she needs power. And maybe she's not the best judge of character. And maybe, you know, there's the way that she also relies on people that she finds deeply distasteful.
Fraught with peril to try and compare anybody directly to anybody else, because everybody's gonna jump in and say, well, she's not like her in this way and that way. We're not is Cersei, just in certain aspects.
I think she's a hell of a lot more sympathetic than Cersei.
Oh yeah,
I will say that. And she seems like she's a good deal
smarter.
She hasn't
twisted any cocks yet, so I'm any baby cocks yet, so I'm all about Alicent, whereas not with Cersei.
Yeah, to our direct knowledge, Alicent hasn't twisted any baby cocks.
Fair.
Which, if you're wondering what the fuck that's from, that's apparently that's what Cersei used to do to make Tyrion cry in the crib, because she's born evil. Turns out she's just bad seed.
Apparently. This is where Laris gives this just psychotic look, right? He's staring off in the middle distance.
It's the second time, and the creepy ass smile. Oh
I
my
hate
god!
The smile.
There's this movie coming out right now called Smile, where everybody's got this creepy ass smile, and then they kill you. Is this effective marketing? Because
might
is
be.
This some cross promotional Warner Brothers shit? Because wow, he looks like he's got a creepy smile that would kill you 7 days after you saw it.
Yeah. And it's entirely inappropriate in this scenario, which makes it even more unhinged. Right. Yeah, I don't like anything about this guy at this point.
Yeah, if you want a prince eye, I'm your servant. I'm your servant, pal, lady.
I got a prince eye guy. I can get you one of those.
Yeah, he does. He does.
Got a whole team of Prince Eye guys.
He's got no tongue, and he's got a lightning bug on his breast, and he'll take an eye. Believe you me.
Rhaenyra asks Daemon to marry her, which blindsided me. Holy shit. Despite being Targaryens, they need Laenor to be dead for that to happen. And we're going to get a montage here in a second, which we'll get into. But I found this super interesting, this scene, because the way that they're playing with the things we saw earlier with their relationship, Daemon and Rhaenyra's, the way they speak to each other when they're very close and trying to be intimate, they speak to each other in Valyrian.
Yeah.
Rhaenyra here starts in Valyrian when she's asking him to marry her, and Daemon responds in English to like shut that shit down. Like, oh, well, Laenor would have to be dead for that to happen. And I found that dynamic like super interesting. I like that detail.
You know, I've long
and,
gone
and it's also a change. Let me say that from when he goes to Viserys and says, "Well, marry Rhaenyra to me," right?
Mm-hmm.
Like that, there was no concern about multiple husbands, multiple wives, none of that stuff. It was all just like, well, yeah, she'd be married to 18 people. I could be married to 18 people. Who cares? Targaryens.
Just to be clear, are you saying, you're saying that this is showing that there's a disconnect between Daemon and Rhaenyra when he refuses to return the High Valyrian call, or is it more of like,
no, I think he's like, it's kind of a test of the waters. Like, how serious about this is she by shutting her down with like English? Like, is she going
like, okay,
to
stop the romance crap? We got a real, you know, we got a real issue that we'd have to solve. You're married.
Yeah.
What are you going to do? You going to kill somebody? Come on. You know,
right.
you're going to pull a lady, right? Rhea.
No, because I think he's into it. It's just how into it is she?
You know, I've long been on record of finding a person calling me daddy in a sexual context a real boner killer.
Mm-hmm.
I think I might have found one even worse when Rhaenyra says, "I need you, uncle."
Yeah.
Can you fucking imagine someone dropping you the uncle in bed?
Uncle.
Oh my God. I'm talking full retraction.
Uh-huh.
Like involuntary retraction. What?
Yeah, like
what?
A turtle head. Like a
God
turtle.
Damn. Yeah. Yeah. There's no way to make that. I need you, uncle. There's no way
there's
to make
no
that
amount
sexy.
Of Viagra that could
so
keep
I,
that.
So congratulations,
going.
Targaryens. Just when I thought you couldn't put me off of your fucking incest, you find a way to keep digging deeper. You finally found my. But you finally found my yuck level.
Yeah.
Jesus. Anyway, they also like, man, the subversion of like your expectations when she goes like, hey, we can't get married unless Laenor is dead. Mm-hmm. And she just hits him with the I know. Yep. And then the soundtrack starts doing this doom, 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 da, da, doom. Like, oh, my God, she's going to kill this guy.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really skillfully done.
And then we get this montage beneath Rhaenyra and Daemon's discussion of ruling through fear where Daemon goes to Sir Carl, propositions him to kill Laenor, at least we think that's what it is. And then Daemon kills a man in Hightide, which seems an odd non sequitur. Carl goes to Laenor and starts a fight. And the next time we see Laenor, his body is apparently burnt to a crisp. And that's kind of where the montage leaves us for a second.
Yeah, there's a couple things interesting in this scene.
Uh-huh.
We noticed the last episode out of nowhere, they threw in a little bit of bisexual lighting on Daemon.
Yes, him flirting
and I thought
with
that
the servant.
Uh-huh. Paid off this episode because when he leans into Carl, I thought it was going to be a seduction.
Me too.
A Matt Smith seduction. I wonder if they are. Is that something? Did they do that just to set up this so you're a little bit off kilter? Or is this just going to be something they kind of keep hinting and leaning into?
I don't know. I mean, now that he's found his like true match in Rhaenyra, right? It's clear he's always been hot for Rhaenyra. Is he going to seek out other lovers? Will it even matter if he is bisexual or not?
I mean,
or is he just gonna
you got a taste for duck and goose and you're with the duck. You're just going to give up goose forever.
If the duck is good enough.
So the duck can be so good it makes up for the lack of goose. Interesting, interesting.
Yeah.
I'd have to talk to a goose duck eater.
What if you were 40, 45 years old, you've been eating
what if
lackluster duck your entire life? It's been like secondhand duck off the back of a truck.
Yeah. Yeah.
Old dry dusty duck, and then suddenly a fresh you have a fresh juicy duck.
Oh, it's greasy,
cooked
it's greasy
to perfection.
As hell. Crispy skin. Yeah,
yeah,
stuff just right.
I think you might eat that for the rest of your life. Yeah,
maybe. I couldn't say.
I don't know what I'm talking about either.
I'm hungry though. I gotta say.
Yeah, I don't even eat duck, but
I thought the voiceover of Rhaenyra and Daemon over this whole thing, where you know they're talking about how a king, you know, I don't want to be a tyrant. I don't want people to fear me. And Daemon's like, and you shouldn't be feared alone. You should be loved and respected. But like all those are worth nothing unless deep down the people fear you, too. And And, you know, granting this kind of set him free. And I'm like, man, this is some cold blooded fucking smack they're talking this whole time.
Yeah, until you realize, no, it's a switcheroo really works in this scene on second watch.
Yeah, it's going to cost them their only remaining child, which it does. Uh-huh. Like, they feel everything about his death and absence. It's just, it's
and they can never say anything to them. Yeah, it's, and only we'll know the truth, right? And everybody else will think the worst of us. I mean, that's still true. And the idea that she's like listening to Damon and taking his counsel on this, I think is interesting, right? She doesn't want to rule through terror. She starts off with, I don't want to do this plan because it would make everybody think that we were monsters.
Right.
And I don't want to rule that way. And Damon, over the course of this montage, talks her into it, essentially.
I'm still trying to figure out whether we're supposed to think the realm is going to suspect them, or is the whole plan to leave witnesses to make sure that there is. It's, I guess if they suspect anything, it's got to be the timing only that, like, oh, who, you know, who, because, like, I mean, even the book says that there are rumors that Damon was behind this because, like, yeah, Sir Carl, he, you know, was a base-born knight and he didn't have any lands and he didn't have any much of prospects and, you know, a little coin in the pocket never helped. But, like, where did that coin come from? And, like, the chief suspects are this, that, and the other. So maybe... I don't know if we're supposed to understand that the realm is going to medium suspect them, because that way we're talking about, like, where does House Valyrian then go down between greens and blacks? If they think Damon, the prince consort, had a hand in the murder of their son.
And yet Damon is the father of their children. I don't know, man.
Yeah.
That's a tough one. That's a sticky wicket.
She was all Rhaenys was already kind of riding hard against that. You gotta wonder.
But Corlys wants his name. It's gonna be interesting. I do think juxtaposing this with the next scene, which seems to happen super fast, where Rhaenyra and Daemon get married, is supposed to tell you that they're trying to sort of put that message out there.
It wasn't like, hey, here's a drawback, let's talk about how we can avoid it. It's more of like, this is not a bug. This is a feature.
Let's lean into it. Let's get married right freaking
there'll
now.
There'll be nothing to connect us, but there'll be maximum suspicion, and that's the zone we want to be in. You know, that's where the small folk can poo-poo it, but, like, the lords and ladies got to take it serious. And, yeah, I can see that. I can see that.
It's good.
I was going to say, I also thought Eve Best just did a tremendous job selling just the, not just grief, but rage that she felt that everything that she was worried about happening because of her husband's escapades have come and he tries to comfort her and she just shoves him away.
How tragic.
That looks like, I don't know what it looks like to lose your kids back to back in these horrific fashions, but I bet it looks something like that because I have completely believed that performance.
And I like that Corlys is, like, angry, but a little less distraught, right? Because he's already secured, like, what he wanted, the legacy.
Yeah. It's like, I felt to me, especially when I watched this multiple times, when he's like, how could you let this happen? It's almost like one of those things where you point a finger and there's three pointed back at you.
You know that
Rhaenys is going to be asking that the same thing. How did you let this happen to your own house? You know, how did you let this happen in my own house? Like, yeah, it's pretty good. Pretty good sequence of scenes.
Yeah. You think she uses that leverage to try and get him to acquiesce on giving Hightide to, or I guess Driftmark to Baela?
I'd be mildly interesting, Jim. What do you think?
Yeah. I think she presses that issue a little bit more. I don't think she's ready to drop that. One conversation. Anyway, so we go to the wedding scene where Rhaenyra and Daemon are married. This has several implications. Like we said, it might make the realm assume that they were in on the death of Laenor. I also guess that Daemon and his family are coming back to Westeros, probably to Dragonstone. Yeah.
Yep, that would make sense. He's finally got Dragonstone, honestly.
Sure.
I like this scene. I like the fact that it seems like a very shotgun wedding. I like the fact that we finally make it through a wedding on Game of Thrones with no one dying. I like the children just like looking deeply unsure and uncertain about this whole thing. And the adults are totally in bliss. I like the costuming. I like
the ritual is cool.
Ritualism of it. I thought this was pretty great.
Yeah. Symbolically, all that cutting and blood kissing and drinking and stuff, it's a little gross to me, but it makes a lot of sense.
I thought they would. The only thing I was surprised when I saw them doing all the blood, I thought there would be some kind of fire. I know I joked about on Instant Take, like that they would like pass their hand over the candle, like Viserys or something. But
yeah,
their words are house or their fire and blood, like. You know, I thought there'd be a little, some kind of fire part of the ceremony too, especially when she said, let's burn together, you know, instead you got this damp, gloomy flame. Environment that they're kind of, the flames are guttering. It feels like, but a lot of blood.
Couldn't they get them a little bit of wildfire? Maybe, just something. Swish it around your mouth and then light that up.
Or have the two dragons breathe fire and mingle their fire together. Or like set some kind of like torch overhead. On fire. That's so you'd have the two bloods becoming one, the two fires becoming one.
Yeah, some kind of big brazier that never goes out, like the Olympics or something. Right?
Condal, I'm available for consulting. Call me.
Sure. For that one scene, yeah.
But yeah, go punch up your religious. I co-wrote a whole book on Fair. Game of Thrones religions. You know, I got some stuff on my CV. Call me.
True. All right. And then the whole game gets changed, as we understand it, when it turns out that Laenor isn't dead. The body burned up was the man that Daemon killed in that weird non sequitur earlier. Laenor and Carl sneak away on a boat, and that's the end of the episode.
Gosh, what does it mean, Jim? What does it mean? What can such a deviation from the canon mean? That's something I've been thinking about the last day or two. I've got some ideas.
Oh, is this a big deviation from canon?
Well, I mean, as far as I can tell in the books, Laenor just dies.
Oh, in that way, okay.
He doesn't escape the Essos. But that's all rumor.
I assume that nothing in Fire and Blood is set in stone, because it's all hearsay and rumor and secondhand accounts.
That's true. And maybe he just goes to Essos and he just never comes back. But I just think it's interesting that they leave this piece on the board.
Okay. Yeah, that is interesting. Who's going to get that information? Who is equipped? Who is equipped to have connections in Essos and desire for power, and someone they desperately want us to forget about because we haven't seen her in 10 years.
Are you talking about a white worm, perhaps?
Uh-huh.
Interesting. Mildly interesting.
Very interesting. And I will say, I know nothing about that storyline.
It's true.
And, you said by canon, he's like basically dead. So,
yeah.
I don't know. I think that might come back somehow.
I might do that's. I'm kind of debating because I dug into a little bit about and seen if I can make some connections about like maybe that they're gonna try to zig where you'd think they'd zag as part of the Maester's Corner. I don't know. I don't know how forward looking I want to be on that, but yeah, something is happening later this week. I'm assuming we're done with the episode. Should I start promoing the feedback? And
yeah, let's do it.
Is that something we do? Hotd at baldmove.com. If you have any feedback, do you want to talk about anything we discussed today or your ideas about the series going forward? Hotd at baldmove.com. We'll be considering that stuff on Thursday. Of course, as always, we're going to be inviting Maester Anthony back to talking to Maester's Corner. I haven't quite figured out the subject that I want to talk about, but he's going to deliver a sermon on the Merlin King, which I'm very excited about. A piece obscure lore I'm particularly passionate about. I can't wait to see what he has to say about that. But hotd at baldmove.com if you want to get on the feedback. You can follow us at twitter.com/baldmove if you want to keep up with our release schedule and what we're doing next and the things we're talking about. And if you want to join us this Sunday for our immediate post-episode discussion, you got to be a club member. You can join at support.baldmove.com and see that Instant Take live and then participate in the Instant Talk where we turn the microphone over to you and you can contribute stuff through the YouTube chat and we'll talk about it that night. Support.baldmove.com if you're interested in that. Otherwise, we'll see you for feedback and then Sunday night for the Instant Take. Until then, I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.